way or fear of you or anything.
I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. The singing ministry of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. It's good to be back. My name is Elliot Morgan, and I'm here with my podcasting partner, Peter Rollins. And this is a podcast where we talk about life and philosophy and some comedy. And and Pete talks about very cool ideas that he thinks are valuable to people's lives. And then I railroad what he has to say and make it about me as much as possible. But we have a very exciting announcement.
We do. Oh my goodness. I was wondering what you're we're getting married.
Yep. Yeah. It's finally happening. We're
Do you know that, by the way, the church used to marry men, heterosexual men could get married.
Really?
In the church. Yeah. It was a medieval practice where now, of course, maybe in reality they weren't kind of straight, but
sure.
The idea was it was two guys who they get on so well, they live together, they want to commit to each other,
yeah.
And it was a heterosexual marriage of men.
Was there like tax breaks back then?
I don't think so.
So what was the point? Was it purely a religious thing?
You know, I don't know.
Well,
you've got to the absolute limit
right.
of my knowledge
yep.
on that subject.
Yeah, yeah. That's my favorite type of knowledge when yep. it's the most surface level. Like, please don't ask me a single other question
yes.
about this. I have a lot of stuff like that from in college when I studied zoology. Like, I can offer the most basic facts about like science, but the moment somebody's like, well, what about, I'm just like, I don't know what
yeah,
you're, I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, just step beyond.
Yeah, you've taken what I learned from my 4-year degree, I just offered to you in one sentence, and that's the extent of it. But anyway, ladies and gentlemen, have officially scheduled, tickets are officially available for the very first Fundamentalists Live.
Yes.
Isn't that exciting?
It is indeed.
Pete, well, why don't you tell the folks about it at home?
Yeah, so we are going to in LA for one night only. I like to say for one night only. But if we sold enough tickets, we'd do it for a month.
We would, yeah, yeah, exactly.
We probably will sell
enough for one night only because we're not popular enough to do it for more than one night.
Yes, to do it twice.
Yeah.
We have found a church. We thought it was appropriate to do
yes.
our first live Fundamentalist in a church with communion wine, well, with wine and
yeah.
beer. And it's going to be on the 29th
Nailed it.
Of August.
Nailed it. And
that's
that is
right.
a Wednesday, folks. It's doors at 7:30. Show starts at 8. I'm thinking of it as a show because it's going
to
be.
I like to call it a service.
Oh, yeah, service.
Yeah,
because
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have communion, which is going to
yeah.
be brought to you by our lovely
it's
friends.
It's a midweek service because churches have that, don't they? They'll have their midweek
yes.
service. And this is the midweek Fundamentalist service.
Wednesday night. When I was growing up, it was if you love the church, you go Sunday mornings. If you love God, you go Sunday nights. But if you love the pastor, you go Wednesday nights. That was a little
oh, is that
sort
right?
of cutesy thing they used to say. But anyway, we're going to have special guests. We're going to have, there's going to be a little bit of stand-up. There's going to be stand-up related directly to the philosophy that the talk that Pete will do beforehand. And then we will sit down. We will do a live podcast. We'll do Q&As, which most of the Qs will probably be on you to A. and it's going to be a great time. There's going to be free drinks. Tickets are available at peterrollins.com. And you can also check our Twitters. You can check our Instagrams. Pete is at Peter Rollins and I'm at Elliot C. Morgan. And Instagram as well is a big one.
You don't really keep your website up to date.
I will add this
you
for sure.
Do, yeah,
yeah,
yeah, I've noticed
yeah.
that you've let that slide.
I let it slide all the time, man. It's like in my mind, no one ever goes to it, but
yeah.
apparently people do. Like I check the back end and I'm like, oh no,
I really should put stuff up.
Yeah,
on this, yeah.
It feels very like exposed when I see that people are going. It's almost like my YouTube channel. Which, speaking of that, we can discuss more of this later. But there's a chance that we might start putting up. Either truncated or full versions of this podcast on my channel if we end up doing
yeah.
that. And I have to figure out how to have the editing capability to put it up, those big files on my MacBook Air. But anyway, we're going to do our first live show. I'm very excited about it. And I think it's going to be really funny and cool and different and unique and welcoming for a lot of people.
Yep.
That's the plug for it, everybody. Speaking of plugs, we're going to go ahead and dive in, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go ahead and start with communion. Communion, as everyone knows, is a very liturgical, very sacred thing. It's definitely not something that should be commercialized in any way. And our communion that we like to do at the top of this podcast is brought to you by triwink.com/thefundamentalists. You can get $25 off your order of wine, and it helps us. And for those of you who have ordered it, which has been plenty of you, please send in your cool looking bottles of wine.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're not into wine, they have like a palate thing that you can do that you can answer other questions about other food, and they'll recommend wine to you, and it's very fun, and it helps us because you know, our rent is going up, and we gotta get some wine sponsorships. So the way this podcast works is Pete dives in with a little bit of a reflection, during which time I shut up, and then we discuss things, and then we have some takeaways at the end. So Pete, what are we talking about today?
So I thought I would jump into a philosophical one today.
I can't wait. Let's switch it up.
Yeah, let's do it. So it basically, in every domain of life, major domains, we're talking aesthetics, religion, politics, science. I think I'm missing one out. But, you know, in these major domains of life, there is two kind of worldviews that are fighting. There is relativism and there is absolutism. And so relativism, in a nutshell, we're going to simplify, obviously, but in a nutshell, relativism is where someone says, we don't have any access to some sort of universal truth, or there is no universal truth. There is just what we think. So in aesthetics, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. In science, well, scientific theories give us a good story that is sometimes useful, but it doesn't give us an insight into reality. In religion, it's like, well, religions are regional expressions of a community's experience of the sacred. Or in politics, politics is really a reflection of what the people at the time in a given country kind of feel overall, and doesn't have any universal connection. It's contingent. So that's relativism. Is kind of everything is contingent. What you believe is a product of your location, your language, what books you've read, how you were brought up.
Hey man, that's just me, dude. That's just me. You got you. You got me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I can speak about my experience, but you know, you can't experience my experience. You can't speak into it, and vice versa. We're monads in the world. And so we have communities, but ultimately there's no way of finding some sort of universal truth. So that's relativism in a nutshell. And then on the other side, there's absolutism.
It's a nutshell to you, but maybe it's like, okay, never mind. Yeah. Stupid joke.
Moving okay, on. I see what you were trying to do
really
there.
Dumb. I'm too tired. Okay, keep going.
We can maybe insert it.
Just me dubbing over. So absolutism, is that where you're...
Absolutism, okay. Yeah. Where, you know, it's the other extreme where someone says, we can know the truth. There is truth and we can know it. Maybe not me, but maybe my community, my religion's right, or my view of politics is correct. The way that we do democracy is right and should be given to everybody in the world. Often absolutism is the person is claiming that what they believe is the truth, because if you're an absolutist and you don't believe what you're saying is the truth, then you would change it, you know. But often actually absolutism romanticizes other cultures. So it says, oh, that culture is a more primitive culture, they're more connected to nature, or, you know, they aren't lost in technology like we are. So you can sometimes romanticize another culture as having the truth that we in the West say don't have. So there's various ways of reflecting it. But absolutism is saying, well, there is such a thing as a beauty. There is such a thing as democracy and truth that is not just valid for me here, but is actually valid for all human beings.
Right.
So there's your two kind of like basic positions, and I say it's in, you find in religion, in politics, in aesthetics, in science, and did I mention aesthetics?
You did mention aesthetics. Yeah, it's interesting. The science one kind of, which we can get into this later.
Yeah,
but the science one is interesting because science is something that's so harped on in terms of like reason and logic and all that stuff, that it's interesting that that's also getting grouped in as being, can be divided into relative and.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a big philosopher of science guy, Paul Feuerbend, who writes a type of relativistic notion of science, and he's a fascinating thinker. I haven't read him for years, but definitely
cool.
He's more in the relativist. Now, the truth is, great philosophers, you won't find them in one camp or the other completely, and that's what I kind of want to jump into.
That's sexy. That's a sexy way. That's a sexy philosopher.
Is some dances between the two.
Yeah, there's a little mystery. It's not going to be labeled too cool for it. Not like,
we'll date both, but not like, you know.
Exactly. Not going to get committed. Yeah. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's where philosophers are, you know, they're not going to be, you know, pinned down too easily in one and the other. So
that might make them happy.
Yeah.
That might alleviate their concerns. Okay, keep going. You got more. This is good.
Yeah, so a philosopher, one of the standard kind of philosophical issues is how do we relate these two together? What is their connection? Because in one sense, they're both right. They both sound right. In one sense, you go, of course, relativism seems true because, you know, what I think is connected to the type of brain I have, the type of experiences I have, the language I have, the books I've read. So, of course, there's some truth to relativism. But then absolutism as well, the idea of like, well, you know, I can debate you. I can, you know, sometimes think you're wrong or you think that I'm wrong. And the very act of debating shows that we believe there's something beyond us that we're arguing towards. So how do they relate? And one of the ways philosophers talk about this is they say, well, think about it like this, that everything is relative, except we are grounded in something absolute. So, for example, in philosophy, you start to argue about what is reason? You know, how influenced are we by our environment? We start to have that discussion. Well, in order to have that discussion, we have to presuppose rationality.
Yeah. Right? Yep. Okay,
it's presupposed.
This is good stuff. Everybody buckle up because he's talked to me before this happened and I didn't follow it. So I'm excited, but pay attention. This is going to be good. This is good stuff.
Yeah. And it's going to get practical. We'll get practical. This is not just abstract. It'll actually have something useful to say.
I can't wait.
Yeah. So the first step is, of course, to say you don't get to reason through argument. You have to presuppose reason in order to argue. So it's in other sense, you don't climb to the truth, you dig to it. You drill to it, like drilling for oil. Same in the legal system is, in a sense, you don't try to make a law just. The very act of writing laws shows that you have already experienced the call of justice. Mm-hmm. So a good lawmaker is trying to express this call in their life in a concrete way. And an artist does the same. They experience some sort of reality that they glimpse this what's called the sublime in the world, and they in fidelity to that experience they paint, right? So weirdly, a philosopher like Tillich will say you can never argue to the absolute. We are completely in the relative world of ethics and morality, but in order to live we are grounded in something absolute that you can't name, but that names you. And in religion this is called, you know, the call of the absolute.
Okay.
But it's not a religious thing in a sense of it's what the artist experiences, it's what the lawmaker experiences. This sense in which what the philosopher Derrida called the undeconstructible. So everything can be deconstructed, but the very desire to deconstruct shows a commitment to truth. And so that's undeconstructible. So weirdly, basically what this boils down to is when I say democracy, what I mean by that word is connected to my experience of life, but democracy holds within it a promise of something that is true of for all of us. It holds a promise that I can never fully grasp, but that's in the word. So freedom, justice, democracy. We can never understand exactly what these are, but our very pursuit of them shows that we are caught up in the absolute.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the basic philosophical idea.
Whew.
But here's a practical example then. Of
I love this. I'm in.
Is that
I'm
right? Lock, stock, you're still.
It sounds like I'm not, but I am.
Yeah. Because here's where it gets interesting. So imagine a Democrat and a Republican.
Ugh.
Right. If you can. And they're having a debate. So first of all, I suppose you could imagine they're both, say, relativists. In other words, they're like, I'm a Democrat, but it's just because that's what I want to be. It's the way I grew up. If you try to convince me otherwise, you're just trying to use your position. You're trying to impose it on me. You're pretending it's reason, but reason is just an expression of your position. It's rationalization. Yeah. So the two people can't convince each other. All they're doing is saying, I'm painting a picture of the world that I like. You're painting a picture of the world that you like. and there's no way of communicating.
Right.
But more often than not, of course, you get two people, a Democrat and a Republican, who maybe are absolutists, who say, in a sense, my position is right.
Isn't that fascinating? That's so fascinating. It gives me more anxiety than I can even... And it's one of those things where it's like I named it recently where I was like, oh, this is a thing that like I'm... It's so fascinating to me that like that both sides, like 50-50 in America is like... I mean, honestly, you know, assuming they were all absolutes, 50-50 is like, what are the odds that like... half of America is like, no, this is how it is. And the other half is like, no, this is how it is. And it's like, how is it that even? Like, that's just fascinating to me. And it's fascinating that everyone is so just like convinced that their position is 100% true. And that if the other side, and then you demonize the other side. I mean, anyway,
And the interesting thing is the more you attack somebody, the more they start to defend their position. So actually like in a relationship, if two people are arguing about something on TV, but neither have a strong opinion on it, but they critique each other, within 10 or 15 minutes, the two people can be arguing like world experts. Where if, in a sense, you change the tone of the debate and one of the people said, you know what, I actually don't really know what I think. The other person might go, hey, I won. But that allows the other person to go, well, you know what, neither do I.
Yeah.
So what happens is weirdly, the more I attack somebody, the more defensive they get and the more absolutist they seem to become. So in debates between, say, a Republican and a Democrat, the whole point is I defend my position and I try to get you to adopt my position.
Yeah.
But a different way of thinking about a debate is where a Republican and a Democrat come in to debate and the Democrat and the Republican both say, listen, you're probably not going to convince me to become the opposite because I have labor invested in my position, as in the labor of thought and all of that. I have emotional investment. I have friends and family in this world, social. So a whole pile of reasons why I'm invested in this system. But I'm going to listen to you because you might help me see some things that I'm not seeing. You might help me become a better Democrat or a better Republican.
Right.
Because, you know, the Republican might say, well, I'm for justice and freedom and democracy. And those are my absolutes. But you know what? There's relativism. Like, I don't know if I'm getting those completely right.
Mm-hmm.
I need to enter this debate so that you can help me see what I'm missing. And vice versa. So the two people come into the debate going, I want to let you speak into my world so that I can experience the difference in my position between the absolute call and the relative way that I express it. And then the second thing about the debate is the gift that you bring is you say, I'm going to help you experience the gap that's within your system between the absolute call and the relative way you express it. So this changes the whole nature of a debate. The idea then is that...
It's like helping each other.
Yes, to become better. And weirdly then, both parties can begin to improve in different ways. Basically, you're introducing plasticity into each other's positions. Plasticity is where you can mold things and change things.
Yeah.
But the more you attack the other, the less plasticity they will have, the more they will get defensive. They'll become absolutist. They'll defend their position and vice versa. But the more you come in and say to the other, listen, I need you to help me see what I'm missing, right? What you know, I believe in freedom and democracy and justice, but you're saying that I don't. So tell me why. And so your eyes allow me to see myself.
Right. So it sounds like you're saying the Tillich thing is like, you know, you pursue these or you accept the fact that everything is relative and blah, blah, blah. But even the very fact that we pursue these things all together in some way, in some capacity, even people who you would dub completely different than you, it still speaks to some sort of absolute grounded thing in life. And so that's very interesting. And it sounds like you're trying to take... Or you are taking that idea and applying it to the idea of a debate, which is going, we are both coming from absolutes. We are also all existing in a very relative world.
Yep.
So let's sort of help each other see the other, you know, relative parts of it, even though we both are coming at it from a common ground of certain things.
Exactly. So what happens? Yeah. What happens then is each party, they can, if they have the courage to see that space in their own position, that can allow for change and can allow for kind of transformation. So take the area of ethics. So that's one area. So the absolute in ethics, one way of describing it, philosopher Levinas talks about this, is the absolute is that individuals are subjects. So Levinas says, the face of the other always says, do not murder me. Which means when you encounter someone else, anyone in the world, you're encountering a subject, not an object that you can use and abuse. Of course, you can use and abuse them, but they are a subject. When you use and abuse somebody, you're reducing them to an object. So the absolute is every time you encounter another, there is this sense of encountering a subject who says, do not murder me, do not abuse me. But how you respond to that call is relative. Like, you have to work that out yourself.
Yeah.
Like, how does that look in practice? And there are certain stars that you can use to navigate. One is, well, you use your ethical upbringing. You go like, well, what's my ethical upbringing said? But it can often be wrong, right? Secondly, you try to listen intently to the other. So you listen to the world, you try to learn, you try to reflect and love. You attempt to be faithful to the subjectivity of the other. You do all of those things, but there's no guarantee you're going to do the right thing, because you still have to have the courage to act without knowing what you should do.
And I think I'm glad you said love too, because I remember, I think it was, the idea of listening to somebody being an act of love in and of itself, like truly listening, because it's exhausting actually sit down and be like, let me hear your side, because I have a very difficult time doing that with people who I don't think are necessarily even close to being right in certain issues. And I'm just like, oh, like I'm so good at just being like, you're dumb one. And that is not a loving thing. That is reducing them to some sort of an object, I guess.
And that's why sometimes actually you have to pay someone to be a listener. And it's not because, oh, you don't have good friends. It's actually because if you want someone to really listen and help as well you to unpack things, you kind of sometimes you actually have to pay someone, because it is such a difficult thing for us all to do.
Yeah.
And by the way, it'd be terrible. How could you be friends with someone who just, you go to the pub and they don't say anything for 2 hours? Mm-hmm. They just listen. I mean, you might find that enjoyable the first time, but it's not really a friendship.
Right. Oh man, that's so interesting. The politics stuff, man, is so fascinating to me. Because in the pursuit of the absolute, like, what is the right way to do things, and you know, I like all the people, you know, I like all the Ben Shapiro's and the Republican people sometimes, and I get really, what interests me, or what I thought about when you were talking about a lot of that stuff, was, you know, we have this president, Donald Trump, and he seems to be very much, I guess, would be in the absolutist area, you know, like Hillary was a criminal, and she was this and she was that. And then I always go back to that clip from 2008 when John McCain and Obama were debating, and it was this town hall debate, and these people were getting up repeatedly implying that Barack Obama was an Arab, and like they were scared and like all this stuff. And I always think about John McCain being like, nope, no ma'am, no, he's a decent man, and he we disagree on policy, but he is a decent, good family man. And I think in some ways that maybe lost McCain the election a little bit, because he wasn't talking to a political party of relative people. He was talking to a political party of absolutists. But I look back at that, I'm like, where did that go? You know, like, where's the person who's like, no, we disagree on this, but there is this. And obviously I'm kind of taking what you're saying and injecting my whole thing into it, which is like, you know, find the common ground. And I'm sure that's a much, ironically, finding the common ground is a very surface level thing to say, but yeah, it's interesting.
No, absolutely. And like, back in Belfast, we set up a group that tried to do this concretely. It was called the Evangelism Project, because we went to be evangelized by other people. So you would go to the Islamic Society, the Humanist Society, the Jewish community. And what would happen is, like, you know, 12 or 15 of us would go. We would, you know, sit and chat. We would, you know, find out a little bit about that community. But then the evangelism would happen. And the evangelism wasn't that we said to the other, listen, can you help us become Jewish or become Muslim or anything like that, right? Because, you know, anyone who converts very quickly, that'd be a bit weird. But the evangelism happened when we said, listen, what does it look like to be a humanist or a Muslim or Jewish in this community? What does Christianity look like to you? Or what does this secular society that you're in look like to you?
What was the most interesting experience that you had doing that?
You know, probably actually with the Humanist Society, we did a version of this with the Humanist group, who were very, you know, rightly, I think, angry about a lot of the violence that has been done in the name of religion and in the name of religion in Ireland. And makes at sense. First, was that?
That makes sense.
That makes it's sense, fair. Yeah. So at first, you know, when we were talking to them and they were expressing some of that, but then what was interesting is we weren't trying to defend it because we were literally going, you were going like, yeah, you think that's bad here, it's even worse. Yeah. Have you heard this story? and what really interestingly happened was that basically we began to see ourselves through the eyes of the other, and we, you know, saw things in ourselves that, yeah, were bad, that needed to be changed. So the evangelism was weirdly, the other is an instrument of our own conversion. So you go to another community and you say, well, what, say it's a group of Christians, for example, you know, what does it feel like to be a Muslim in this town? What does Christianity look like to you? Then you see yourself through the other's eyes, and then you're challenged to be evangelized. You're challenged to change, to try to adapt. And the way that happens is because you have to experience the disconnect between the absolute call that you're trying to be faithful to respond to what is truth, what is justice, what is love. But
and
the
all
relative
the bullshit
nature,
you signed up for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
all and the layers bullshit. And layers of bullshit.
Yep, exactly. And funny. The challenge is not to think that you can get beneath all the layers of bullshit to the truth, but almost that the truth is what is dispersed throughout the bullshit. it's what holds it up. And so here's the weird thing is people think of conversion as moving from one position to another. So, you know, you move from, you know, humanism to Christianity or to Buddhism or to Hinduism, but you can just move from one position to the other, but you hold it in the same way. You hold it in the absolutist way. Mm-hmm. The true, really genuine and difficult conversion is not necessarily changing your position, but rather experiencing the relativity of it within its absolute. So in other words, you hold your position, but you hold it as fractured, as broken, and you allow others to speak into it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of philosophy in this, what it has to say, I think, to the contemporary world is how do we hold our positions with respect and with pride and with love, but also see within those kind of things that need to change and develop.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of bravery in that pursuit that gets kind of glossed over because it's always this sort of like, especially in these conversations that can be very like abstract or theoretical or whatever. It's like that's a very like terrifying thing. I think that like what in my experience, one of the things that terrifies me about growing older is I always worry that one day I'm going to maybe be the absolutist person, or that I'm going to, that level of like curiosity is going to just go away. And I think that disconnects, that's a major disconnect that I feel specifically with a lot of, you know, relatives and their political opinions. It becomes sort of like, you know, like I feel like what you're talking about requires like a curiosity that allows you to do that. Otherwise it's just sort of, I guess that would be an absolutist, I guess. Yeah. So it's like when you're dealing with people who are just sort of like, no, this is it, this is what it is. And I bet you experience this a lot in the world of philosophy, because I mean I'm sure that world is just filled to the brim with people who are like, no, this is it. Or maybe they're I'm wrong.
Like I think every realm in a sense is, including philosophy.
Comedy is a big one. There's I get very frustrated with what I call comedy elitists and people who think that like this person's funny, that's not funny, this is funny. Oh, yeah. And that's a very like sort of ego driven thing where there's no lightness to even the pursuit of comedy, which to me is the most like counterintuitive thing in the world. Yeah. But anyway, you have to like start, I think, with the, and then there's like a fear too, because it's like the moment you have that curiosity, it opens you up to the possibility that your positions aren't correct. Yeah. And I don't know, it's so
the opposite's a big danger. Like I think actually for someone like you and for me and for many of us today, the opposite is actually even more inviting, which is just to go, listen, what's right for you is right for you, what's right for me is right for me. I'm going to disengage from all
so
of
sad.
The craziness.
That's a tragedy. Yeah.
And those, I think those, both of these extremes, they're not philosophical positions because they're not that strong, really, but they're existential positions that we are tempted to take.
Yeah.
You know, either we want to avoid the anxiety of being wrong through absolutism, through somebody telling us the truth, having the answer, or we want to avoid getting our hands dirty by just, you know, checking out of society and just going, ah, whatever, let's all be individuals, be apathetic. Opening yourself up to the call of the absolute is this incredibly difficult and courageous act where you try to existentially remain open to the what Derrida called the undeconstructible, to justice, democracy, and freedom, while not closing down the fact that the way we articulate those will always be fragmented, partial, broken, and open to development.
I think there's also like this, I mean, if we're just going to get into like total self-help and like whatever, but like it seems to me that the language that you're using could very easily be applied to like marriages and relationships where you're like, you know, if your pursuit is love and fidelity and commitment, and those are your absolutes, or you have an absolute to, you know, I don't know. And then everything else on top of that can become incredibly malleable. I mean, I have friends who have relationships that are, you know, so healthy, but they're so different than anything I personally have experienced or maybe necessarily would want, but they make it work because there's that call of the absolute within there.
Yeah. That's right. Because dynamic. You can either, if you think of plasticity, either a plastic is so cool that just it becomes brittle. Mm-hmm. So relationships where, you know, some, one person thinks they're right or two people think they're right, and it's just always arguments and fights. Or with if plastic gets too hot, it can't take any shape at all, which is two people who live together, but they don't engage at all. They just like, you know, I don't care what you think. I don't care. You don't care. Let's just, you know, not get into any discussions. Let's not talk about anything because, hey, what you think is just what you think. What I think is what I think. And it takes great courage and great commitment to somehow navigate how those are actually interrelated, how we can argue and enrich each other's lives through discussion, but that none of us, you know, get to the peak. The absolute is not something you argue to.
You're
it's what's presupposed in the argument itself.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, I think the one group that, at least in the political spectrum, that I am just like out on is the non-curious and the absolutist, to the point of like, I kind of, because I think I can use the relative thing, and I've done this before. My friends have kind of called me out on it, but like I can constantly justify positions within the Republican Party and within, you know, that world, because it's what I was raised in, and it's also very tied to just who I am. And so there's this thing in me that is probably based in a lack of bravery or courage on some level, where it's just like I can't detach fully from those opinions. And it's and so it's like, on one hand, it's like, yeah, totally, like, you know, there's a value to just being like, well, this is my position, but accept it that it's fractured. But there's also, I would hate to jump on that bandwagon so hard that I just don't, that I'm also not honest with myself when I go like, oh no, I just think I can't get behind this anymore. And then when I can't get behind it anymore, that's sort of a leap that I take personally, and that I am sort of being able to articulate now. But in doing so, what I've found is that it's very easy to do that as long as I'm not talking to somebody who is devoid of curiosity and devoid of I guess humility with their opinions. I don't know. It's very, because I can use the ideas that we're talking about to make bridges to dead ends, there's nothing on the other end besides somebody who has no ability to see that I'm even doing that. No ability to appreciate it or have any value with it, because they themselves have to be locked in and cocooned in their own, in their own crap.
Yeah. And I mean, and
cocooned in their own craft is the title of
that. That's good. Yeah.
Cocooned,
I like that.
In your crap.
That's your next poem.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we see it so much at the moment is that, but it's almost like people are a lot more full of doubt than they'll often express. But it's the whole point is whenever I attack somebody or whenever I force them to defend themselves, then they will tend to argue for their position much more strongly and stridently. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the more that you can open yourself up to going, you know, I do believe in love, and I do believe that we should make the world a better place. I feel called by that.
Yeah.
But I'm totally up for saying I don't have a first clue sometimes how that looks, and I can be wrong. That actually can allow the other person to do the same. So the great thing is, the world we live in at the moment might look like everyone's taking these absolutist positions, everyone's fighting. But if we can create communities that express this type of life we're talking about, that can actually have a very massive effect incredibly quickly.
What does that tell you about society if we're in this sort of very like, because I mean, I imagine that is, that's partially, we talk a lot about this in sort of like culture right now and what happens on Twitter. And I wrote a, I did a video yesterday for a new project I'm doing called Bootleg Universe. Check it out, folks, if you'd like to. It's Adi Shankar, I think is his last name. But I did this video called The Rise of the Obnoxiouses, and it was about how obnoxious people keep becoming more and more successful. And like you have Danielle Bergoli, who was this girl who went on Dr. Phil, and she was this incredibly obnoxious, like sort of embodiment of I don't know, like rudeness. And okay. She became massively successful. And I was almost took the video in the direction of like, we're assuming that means that she's rewarded, but actually it's probably going to ultimately not be a reward when you get that level of fame and fortune at that age. But Donald Trump is obnoxious. He gets successful. The Logan Paul, Jake Pauls of the YouTube world, they thrive off of being obnoxious, literally obnoxious people, and they become massively successful. And I was like, the whole point of the video was like, what is it? Like, what are these people serving? Like, clearly, what need are they fulfilling? Because clearly there's a gap in society where maybe we need obnoxious people right now. Because
exactly. This says more about sometimes our society than it does about the individuals. Why do we need to make these people famous? And why do they sometimes need to play into that? Because like, so I don't know Logan Paul at all. And I've seen a few videos. But part of my concern is that potentially he's being positively reinforced to express negative parts of himself that we all have. Yeah. And actually, he could have gone a very different direction and still can go in a very different direction. But what's happening is he is getting constant negative reinforcement by wider society because we need him to be like that.
Yeah.
Not all of us, but a large number of us. And what does that say?
Because I was talking in the video, but I was like, I'd never really thought about it till I sat down and was writing it. But like, when I get on Twitter, it's like every one of my peers and colleagues is like a saint. The line that I use was like, I had no idea that I was growing up in a generation of saints and people who just have it all figured out. It's remarkable. And like every person is like, they stand up for justice and inequality. And their opinions on pop culture even are perfectly aligned with the most disenfranchised group of the day. And it's like, some of that stuff is really good, I think. But then on the other hand, it's like exhausting. I'm looking at my peers and my friends, and I'm like, how is it that you're so perfect all the time? Yeah. And what do we do then with when there's moments of imperfection or there's moments of like not being on that level? And then who do we go to with that? Because clearly we can't go to the people online. We can't go to the social media thing because, you know, if you express any kind of anxiety and then all of a sudden you have this sort of like, you know, it's like cockroaches that scatter in the light or whatever. And then you get cockroaches that become president. It's just like this, but I don't remember exactly what you said that got me on that tangent, but I think it had something to do with what you were talking about.
Well, I mean, I see this as funny since I've noticed this anyway, that on both sides, sometimes people refer to Jesus. I don't even think it's a religious thing, but it's like, you know, Republicans might say, well, Jesus would be for this, you know, this policy, this idea. Mm-hmm. And then liberals will say, well, Jesus would be for this kind of policy or this idea. And it reminds me of one of the defense mechanisms that people have is where if you put your ideas onto somebody else. So you say to the therapist, I know what you're thinking, or I know what my mom would think about this.
My favorite is I was having a conversation with my friend and he said this about me, or they said this.
Oh yes. So, depends, because if they said it, then they did say it. But if you say, oh, they think this, whereas they haven't even said anything.
It's like both. Sometimes they say it, but then I rather than say, I think this, because my friend said it, I'm just like, I package it in a way because I'm too embarrassed to be like, I think this is blah, blah, blah. So anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. We all do that.
Yeah. That's good to know.
But it's the same thing with figure of Jesus. Funny, it's like, it's not that I think this, it's that Jesus thinks this. So I'm in agreement with Jesus. So what one does is one takes one's, you know, position, puts it on the other.
Look, man, you don't have to agree with me, but just so you know, I do. Jesus agrees with me.
Yes. So. Yeah, exactly. So it's like Jesus thinks this and I'm just, you know, putting myself in line with Jesus. When of course that's like, no, well, you think this, you're putting it on to Jesus, then you're pretending that Jesus is putting it on to you.
Yeah, was it Luke where Jesus bullshit as much as you're bullshitting right now?
And you know, but that's like, it's a universal thing we all do. But I've noticed that with Jesus in America is used as that example on both sides.
Yeah,
and again, it's like this desire to put our thoughts into an absolute form. So Jesus becomes a symbol of the absolute. Well, what Jesus thinks is absolutely correct. And so the way that I graft my contingent political position, which might be a good political position, but I want to make it stronger. So I put it in the mouth of Jesus. It's interesting. And both sides
do it. That's so interesting.
And both sides do it, and then both sides ridicule the other. Mm-hmm. So it's like one side can't imagine Jesus saying what the other side is saying, and they laugh at it, but both feel exactly the same. They feel exactly the same, you know. It's funny to watch.
Man, we're so dumb. We're all so dumb. That reminded me of the cake, the bakery, the cake.
That
they ruled in the favor of the bakery to like not serve cakes to gay people. And it's one of those things where if you like talk to somebody on the Republican side, they're like, well, you know, that's like, you know, it's a protection of the freedom of religion, you know. And then it's like, shut up, like stop, you know, where it's like you sound like you're full of shit, and it's like, don't, you know, anyway, but it's that like using the religion thing is you're right, it's trying to align your, what is it, like putting a band-aid on the doubt that you have about your actual opinion, so hide it behind religion. Is that maybe happening?
We often do that.
So yeah, the debate idea is fascinating to me, because I think I think debating is so dumb most of the time, and it's like, it's definitely entertaining, and I love it on like an emotional level, but I don't think I've ever really walked away from a political debate in any way being like, that was cool. Now that said, I'll watch like, you know, the Russell Brands and like the Sam Harris's and all that stuff, but it's like, you listen to them and you're like, this isn't going to change anything. Yeah. And then you get the people who now there's this big movement where it's like, the people are just like obsessed with debates, like free and open exchange of ideas. And it's like that assumes that these people actually believe what they think. And it assumes that they are able to be malleable by the other person. And none of that is typically the case in my experience, but people love to harp now on debates and this, and it's like, well, let's just talk it out. And it's like, it's not gonna do it. You're just making money. That's all you're doing. You're just filling an auditorium with college kids who think that they're like privy to something. But anyway, it's cynical what I'm saying right now.
Yeah. And there's different forms. So you can have like, and I think YouTubers are good, as often podcasts are a different form of debate. Like a good YouTuber or a good podcaster might bring in a guest and have a good conversation. And it's not about, you know, me defending my position, you defending yours, but you can kind of create more of an exchange of ideas. And so like, I think that you can package a debate where there was a series of books I really like. They were from the 60s, I think. But they were called Objections To. And so there's Objections to Christianity, Objections to Humanism, Objections to, there's like four or five of them. But they were written by people within those communities.
Cool.
So Objections to Christianity was written by Christians. Objections to Humanism was written by humanists, et cetera, et cetera. I was, you know, a very simple idea, but it was really nice, because usually objections to are said by an opponent, as if the people who have a position don't have objections to their own position. So it'd be interesting to have debates in universities where the idea is that two people come along, say what they think, but also go, right, but I genuinely want to hear why I will genuinely critique my position, and or I will genuinely listen to your critique.
Sounds like you're talking about a gosh darn utopia land, like a wonderland. Like, I just don't see, I can't imagine. I don't think we live in a current era where that's happening very often, where people are like, let's see what you think. Cause it's so just like frenetic and crazy right now.
I know. That's why, I mean, this is the weird justification I have for creating communities, which is part of my work, is that I think that the way to do this is to create communities that try to enact these things in their, you know, with 10, 20, 50 or 100 people. And you have enough communities like that, it can actually change things. But that really, sadly, we just have to try to start enacting this stuff in our own environments. But if you, I think, you know, a good political leader can do it. Now, they have to be very talented, but they can come in and completely disarm a debate by going like, no, I'm here to listen. I'm here to to learn or whatever. There's ways to do it, but we don't see it very often.
Yeah. Because there will, I mean, and how could there be, like, that's a risky move when you got millions of dollars behind you.
It's a risky move. But it's like a relationship where two people think they're right will just escalate and escalate and escalate until violence erupts and a breakdown erupts. The only way out is often getting a third person to come in and where you can start to express your feelings, listen to the other, express your doubts, learn from the other. That's the only chance the relationship has. And so in the same way in politics, if a politics of absolutism, it will just continue to get worse and worse until the resentment explodes in violence. So there is a sad possibility that, you know, we're going towards like, there'll be some massive explosions of violence. And we're already seeing that, but even
yeah,
bigger.
It is kind of, we were talking about that a little bit last night. It's like something's gonna pop here. Like, it's not good. And it's, I would say, legitimately kind of scary. But you're definitely, we're seeing like the constant, like, nonstop just anxieties getting just like, fah, fah, fah.
Yes.
And
yeah.
It's like, here it is. Yeah. Such a weird, weird world that we're living in right now, man.
Yeah. And then I say the opposite then is then some people are just tempted to check out. You know, they go like, there's no point in me engaging in debate because as soon as I engage in debate of any kind, I'm going to be shot down. Blah, 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 blah. So, you know what? Let's just, I'm just going to check out, do my own thing. And so absolutism and relativism as positions are intertwined because either you think you're right or maybe you're tempted to question, but then you go, I'm just going to get shot down. So like, you believe what you believe, I'll believe what I believe. It is actually very difficult to in any environment to try to bring nuance in.
Yeah, I think I see that happening a lot right now online and in the Twitter sphere of, I don't see it happening, which is precisely why I think it is happening, which is I'm like looking at comment sections and I'm looking at Twitter threads. And I'm like, I'm having in-person conversations and I'm seeing a lot of people who are just like, we're staying silent for right now. We're just, we're hunkering down and there's like a storm that everyone is kind of waiting to pass on a social level. That's really sort of fascinating to see.
Yeah.
Cause I relate on both ends where it's like, let's dive in, let's discuss this. We can learn more about each other. But I think people are learning more about each other. It's really nice. Like in gender stuff, like men and women, I think, it's very good, it's very healthy, but I also see a lot of people just going like, I don't touch that, like we're not touching that. And it's a self-preservation thing, which speaks to probably a lack of comfort or a lack of bravery in expressing their own things and maybe considering the fact that possibly they're wrong. I don't know.
Sometimes it can be just wise to obviously take a breath and not jump into a conversation, but it is these two are interconnected. The more one ratchets up, the more the other kind of can be a response to. And
it's like, I mean, the whole election of them, you know, there's a silent majority and then everybody, no there's not, the polls say that, and I'm like, no, there's people aren't getting polled, they're not, and if they are getting polled, they're probably not saying the truth all the time. And I remember before the election where I was like, this guy's gonna win, like it was in the primaries. Oh, yeah. And I called that pretty quickly, and then which I don't know why I brag about that. But I was like, this guy's more charismatic than any of the other ones and he's going to win. But then there was, the polls aren't going to. And I'm like, no, there's no, you can't. I don't think you can trust the sampling sizes that we're seeing right now these days between Twitter and, you know, the elections that are happening. I'm just like, I think that we're all kind of, the everything's up in the air right now in terms of where people are actually falling politically and socially. So man, I'm like not at all bringing lightheartedness to this.
I know, it's good. These are good things to talk
like,
about. Yeah.
I'm like, I mean, obviously I'm a little tired, but I'm like, Elliot, just say something, like lighten the hell up for a second. My God. But there's so much tied into it. I mean, you're talking about political debates and positions and absolutism versus relativism. That is heavy stuff because it does get to the core of like so many things. Even in especially going back to the romantic stuff, going back to love and beauty. And do you think there's absolute beauty? There has to be absolute beauty. I can't believe that there wouldn't be absolute beauty. That's absolutely, like a sunset's absolutely beautiful. That's, it just is, Pete. I don't know what to tell you.
It's all right.
I'm going to write a book on this.
Yeah.
Sunsets are beautiful is the new title of the podcast.
If you don't like sunsets, you should be killed.
You should be killed.
Yes,
you
should be. That's, you are that's, inhuman. That's the problem with absolutely. It always leads to that. It's like, yeah, hey, we're going to kill him.
Yeah. No,
yeah. Well, yeah.
We're going to kill him.
Yeah. You've got to kill him. Yeah, in this, in terms of aesthetics, yeah, the logic would be then, it's like, there is beauty, but again, beauty is not something that you directly see. It's what inspires the painter to paint. So it's this weird turnaround where instead of ever, we naturally think that beauty is something you kind of get to or you see. But in this notion we're talking about is beauty is what inspires a painter to paint. So the beauty is the is this undeconstructible, this the air that they breathe. But every time you paint a painting, it's never going to live up to beauty.
Yeah.
So it's so therefore it's a contingent thing. So no painting kind of gives the sublime, but the painting at its best is what could be called a worshipful fidelity to the call of the sublime in the hands of an expert.
A worshipful fidelity to the call of the sublime is
the title.
Is the title. A worshipful of your autobiography to the call of the sublime.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah, that's great, man. Yeah. I was going to say, like, as soon as I was like, sunsets are always beautiful, I was like, well, if you're depressed, they're not beautiful. Like, if you're like a sad person. But then that doesn't change the fact that maybe that it is beautiful, but you can't experience the beauty because of what's happening on your internal.
And that's why, like, for Kant, the sublime is, so the sublime is the aesthetic absolute. And what the sublime is it's like these moments, and sunsets are one of them for people, but these little moments where you see something in a natural world that's stunning. But weirdly, what it does is it doesn't give you the sublime. What it does is it negatively points towards it. So you see something so beautiful, but weirdly it testifies to something even more beautiful that you cannot see. So the sublime is mixed with melancholy. That's why melancholy is so important for an artist. It's like you see something stunning and yet it simultaneously withholds something. So it simultaneously testifies to something even more wonderful and beautiful. And so, yeah, that's the sublime.
Cool,
the sublime,
you just ruined sunsets.
Yeah.
You just ruined sunsets for people. Next time, I'm going to Florida in a couple weeks, and when I see that sunset, I'm going to be like, this is beautiful, but it speaks to something sad. See how that goes over for everybody. No, it will be fully beautiful because I'll be having a margarita. I'm very excited.
You're next week, you're away.
Next week and then the week after that. So we got to figure out, we got to record some podcasts. I'm going to VidCon, and then I'm coming back from VidCon. And then I'm going to Florida
the next week after that.
I know, man. It's going to be, you go away for long periods of time, and then I'll come back and we'll do more. And then we'll start prepping for our live show on August 29th at Central Avenue Church. At which point I'll probably be far more awake and vibrant than I am in this particular episode. I'm sorry I didn't, you carried this one.
No, I feel bad. I think I started off by talking about like Republicans, Democrats, absolutism, how the world is violent and terrible, and then going like, so make a joke about it.
Yeah, so what do you got?
How are you gonna make that lighthearted?
Yeah.
Let's paint this black see what you can see what you can say.
I know. And I always go back to this too with this particular podcast because I do feel like I'm not trying to be
yes, this is
funny.
Not, no.
So it's like, I feel like it's like the, like in name, this is like, oh, it's a comedian and a philosopher. That's going to be so crazy to listen to. But mostly it's like, I'm just really curious about this stuff and I like it. But I also do use it to write my comedy, but I don't write my comedy.
Well, it's the same for me. Like we're not doing like technical philosophy at the moment. We're talking using kind of philosophical ideas. So both of us are like, it's a philosopher and a comedian having a conversation.
Right. I think that's a good clarification for you specifically to make, because I would hate to give the impression in this particular podcast that we're like doing lessons on various things. Cause like, there's no way, I mean, I can understand most of what you say and you're still just giving me like, you know, kind of like palatable versions of these very, very like deep, deep schools of thought. And from that, you know, so much can be sparked. I love doing it, but it's like, at the same time, it's so, I hope it gets people interested in this stuff a lot.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Cool, man. What's your, you know what? I'm going to start with a takeaway.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a break.
Thank you. What's your takeaway? Sunsets are beautiful.
Pete, sunsets are beautiful. My takeaway in terms of relativism and absolutism is that I'm not going to feel bad anymore when I both have a belief, a not sometimes naive belief, that I can penetrate somebody's relative bullshit and see past it, because perhaps maybe there is an absolute that we are all sort of fighting for. And so therefore, that will probably be something that I hopefully continue to age with and have. And yeah, that's it. And then on a personal level, I would venture to say that I don't think I suffer from debate, from thinking that debates or that opposing views can't change mine. So I think that, like, it's all, speaking of relative, there's probably people who need that. And I think I almost am too far on the other end, where it's like, you know, if somebody comes up to me and they're like, you know, this, you know, and this is like gun control or something like that, or not gun control necessarily, but certain issues, I can hear it and I'm like, okay, cool. All right, great. Well, that makes sense. And it's there are facts and there are things and all that stuff, but I need to actually probably tighten up a little bit. But then in doing that, maybe I can connect with other people. So, whew, not good, man. Not a good takeaway. Lackluster. Felt like I was full of shit. What do you got? Well,
we're all full of shit.
And that concludes our...
Yeah, I suppose in relation to this, my takeaway is that, you know, we all have a temptation to either check out of things or to sometimes think we've got the right answer and all of that. But that, you know, the challenge for us is to try to remain faithful to a call. And that call is for an artist, the aesthetic. The call for a lawyer is justice. The call for a religious person is, you know, the absolute or whatever. A philosopher might be reason. But
comedian
these
is girls.
Girls, that's right.
There we go. He got a joke in it.
Finally, at the very end. Oof, thank God. Yeah.
But you were like interviewing comedians to replace me.
Yes. Yeah,
so, wouldn't blame.
But yes, yeah, so we have like democracy, justice, freedom. These inspire us. And yet, we realize that how we understand those are always open to change and always open to rethinking, and that we remain open to other people who'll have different perspectives that will enrich our own. So there you go. That's my takeaway.
I loved it. Thank you so much. I learned a lot in this one. This is a good one. This is a meaty one. So thank
you. Well, you know, I'm worried because there's the next week. We started talking about violence and resentment, and I would love to do one on resentment and how resentment functions, but it might be another too deep one. Maybe we need to go shallow, but no deep. I think, yeah.
Resentment I can have probably more fun with than violence.
Yes.
One I can relate to a lot more than the other.
Yeah.
All right, folks, thank you for listening. See you next week. I think when I lose that.